some time ago I gave a sermon to talk about the false Christs and false prophets that Jesus Christ warned about, and very direly warned about them, how that is sure to come in the last days. The first signs appear, they will get so deceitful. When those signs come along, the signs of the false prophets and false Christs, when that happens, they're going to get so deceitful as to severely tempt even the very elect. Now, Jesus warned about that. And I thought that if that goes on long enough, which it's going to run for some time and go on, and things are going to happen along the way, and there will be deceptive signs that Satan is going to give, and I pointed that out. But that can lead to discouragement, and that's what I want to talk about today, is the matter of discouragement. And I think we all know that whenever things drag on like that, problems drag out and drag out, that we tend to get discouraged if things are not going our way. Now, we live in a complex society. We all know that. And I have thought a great deal about that as far as that goes, and wonder how gleeful Satan must be to that as far as we are concerned in being so tightly knitted into the society in which we live. It was altogether different when I was a child, I'll assure you. You know, we were almost self-sufficient. I say almost. We lived off of the land, and we had a little old pot-bellied stove in the house to heat the thing, and 20 below zero, why we could stand up and get warm on one side and then turn around and freeze on and get the frozen side warmed up on the other side. And but we were self-sufficient almost. And we raised our own crops and so forth. What would we do today? Think about it. If we didn't have the circumstances we have. I don't wish to say that to frighten anyone, because I know treacherous times are going to come. How all those things are going to come about, I don't know. Because there are many things that indicate that technology will be being used all the way up to the end. And I know that too. But discouragement, that's an interesting word. Discourage. You look it up in dictionary and Webster's, and he gives a couple of definitions that I want to just touch on. You see, first off, dis means opposite or against, like disobey. Discourage means lack of courage, obviously, or the opposite, if you please, of courage. Webster says, number one, deprive of courage or confidence. Disheartening. Now, number two, and I want to deal more with this one. It says, to hinder by disfavoring, to deter. That's A under number two. And B, to attempt to dissuade. To attempt to dissuade. We live in a world where we are under those conditions all the time, let's face it. Where there's a power of the spirit of that now influences the air. I'll turn to that in a minute in Ephesians, the second chapter. But that dissuading force is always there. Something happens, and bingo, we look at the downside of that almost immediately. That's the way we're rigged. Sorry about that, but the society at large is, that's just about the way it is with us. I hope you realize that. When those trials come upon us, and we tend then to, oh no, here comes the worst, and it gets worse and worse and worse, and we look at it about that way. And you know what? when we have that frame of mind and attitude, that's about what'll happen. Just about what'll happen. It gets worse and worse and worse until we finally get a hold of ourselves and get to looking to God where we should have looked right off the bat in the first place. And until we do that, why, things so often, all too often, just keep getting worse once something opens up and happens in forms of trials that we have. It makes us fearful to face reality. Think about it. We don't like to face the real facts of the matter when we have problems and trials. The real facts, we tend to think, oh no, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And when we think that way, sure enough, it does. I remember the time I walked into I can't even say it now, one of the big supermarkets down in Beaumont, Texas, anyhow. And it happened to be in the evening when there wasn't a great deal of business, but this lady in that style, and I was the only one that walked in there, and I tossed this little 15-cent item, whatever I bought, on the counter. And she was sort of looking down, and I mean her face was, as I said, so long she could have drunk out of a churn. she was really sad looking. And I walked up and threw this down, and whenever I looked up at her, I had a smile on my face, and she looked at me, and I said, you know, somebody told me, oh, cheer up, things could be worse. So I cheered up, and sure enough, they got worse. And I thought she was going to roll. She said, I must have looked horrible when you walked up here. She said, let me tell you why. She said, they put us on these turnstiles for 4 hours, I think she said, limit. And they leave us here. She says, my relief was supposed to have been here a half hour ago. She said, since you came through here, I can stay here till midnight. It won't bother me a bit. cheer up. It can help sometimes. And it helped that lady in that situation. I only mention that because it wasn't a severe trial. It wasn't that bad a thing as far as she was concerned. I'm only illustrating the fact that if we have a pleasant frame of mind rather than to get down and discouraged and offbeat as far as that is concerned, instead of fearful to face reality, it's better to get hold of ourselves. I'm still alive. I've been through lots of trials. And God has carried me through somehow. You know, sometimes it gets right down to where I think, oh, no, it's, you know, I've lived my life and I've had some, I wonder many times how I am alive from some of the trials I've had. But I'm alive. I'm still here. God has seen me through. I know that. I know that now. Back in those days, before I was ever converted, I had no idea of that. I have to admit that. I was that dumb. Excuse me, but I was. And I had to realize that. I said I would turn to show you Ephesians, the second chapter. That's what I want to turn to. Ephesians 2, and starting in verse 1. We all know this verse quite well, I'm quite sure. I want to quote it because I stated here a little while ago that Satan is always ready to help out whenever we get into difficulty. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 1. And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins. Now, maybe we don't like to say it that way, but you see, before God called me, I really didn't have the seed of life, to be honest about it. I was dead. I was living dead, if you please. Just put it that way. Absolutely sure to die. This physical body is sure to die. I know a lot of people think I'm going to live forever, but it ain't so. It ain't so. Excuse me. my English. But we were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked according to the course of this world. Now, when we walk according to this world, of course, we're living in it, and we have to deal with it. We have to live in it. According to the prince of the power of the air. the Spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. You think it doesn't work in us because we are wanting to obey? No, don't think so. He's the prince of the power of the air. I breathe that air. Same air Jesus Christ breathed. And he was tempted in all points like as you and I are, yet without sin. So the temptation itself is not sin. It's when we give in to it and when we yield to it, just as discouraging things happen. And once we start off on that track, look out, because it can get worse and worse and worse. And when we think that way, it usually does. I cited that case as far as that lady was concerned in that store, but you see, Satan, the devil, always wants us to think the way that of the world, to think of this way, that he's the god of this world. And he wants us to think in that way, in harmony with the world. Now, unfortunately, we have seen an awful lot of people that have done that even in the Church of God in the last 10 years. And they have. I want to turn to 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, because Peter gives us a little good advice on all of this, too. 1 Peter, the 5th chapter. Maybe find it here somewhere in my Bible. I think I can. 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." And if he can get you started down that track of discouragement, he'll carry it right on down. He'll carry it out. Keep you getting more and more discouraged if he possibly can, because that's what he wants, is to have you devoured, because you have the potential to become a son of God. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. They are. We all have trials and temptations. There's no question about that. I brought the today's English version of the Bible along just for that verse. I wanted to read that passage, 1 Peter 5 and verse 8 out of today's English version. Not because I think it's more accurate. That's not the point. It just happens to be in a little plainer English is all, as far as I think, anyhow. Chapter 5, I said, can't even find it here. Where is it? And verse 8, be alert and be on watch. Your enemy, the devil, and he certainly is your enemy, especially so once you submit your lives to God, repent and are baptized and receive God's seed of life, his Holy Spirit. Your enemy, the devil, roams around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Now, who is he going to find? If he finds you discouraged, well, he'll know that right then and there, and he'll just pick up on that and carry on. You can rest assured of that. Looking for someone that he may devour, be firm in your faith and resist him, because you know that your fellow believers in all the world are going through the same kind of sufferings. The same kinds of sufferings. Maybe not exactly the same thing. The same kind of sufferings. How do we suffer? You know, we suffer mentally a lot of times to our hurt. And I have often said that I think it even affects our health, our physical health a lot of times. The frame of mind we have about these things really does affect us. And I'm a believer of that, as far as I am concerned. When we are faced with discouragement and problems and trials that come upon us and they slam down on us, where do we turn? Well, we know where the help is. the only source of help that we should look for. James, the fourth chapter, since I'm right here in 1 Peter, go to James. He gives us some advice in all of this. Chapter 4 and verse 5, I'll start, where it says, "Do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit that dwells in us yearns jealousy? But He gives more grace. Therefore, He says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God." Submit to God. "Resist the devil, and he'll flee from you." Satan ordered him, Jesus Christ ordered him away. Now, the power of God can do that. I'm sorry to say that I don't like to give sermons about demons, but I've had to cast them out in any number of situations. And it's only by the power of God that He'll do that. I can't do that, and I know that. But God can, and Jesus Christ could call on God, to the power of God, to cast Satan away, to resist him. That's what we need to do. Resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. Draw near to God, and he'll draw near to you. Now, that's what we want. There is the solution to any discouragement at any time. If I were to be forced to starve to death, that'd be pretty discouraging. Where would I go? If I go to God, I want to die, if I starve to death, under God's care. Now, that's pretty harsh, and I don't think God's going to allow that, if we really trust Him. Because I've been in pretty severe trials in my time. I was reared back in the Depression or the drought days, whenever we had to carry water out to even grow a few vegetables, 1934. I remember that very well, and helped carry some of that water so we had some vegetables to eat. But we ate. And it was no use getting discouraged, because we had to work together as families then. And we did. But, you see, we draw nigh to God and He'll draw near to you. I didn't know God at that time. I'm sorry to say, I was just a teenager. And, now I prayed to God, as far as that goes. The same God. I know better than that. I know the church has taught many times that people outside of the church of God actually pray to a wrong God. Well, no, I pray to the same God I always prayed to, as far as that part is concerned. I just really didn't know Him, that's all. He knew me. You can rest assured of that. And I know that there are times when He protected me, and no doubt in my mind about that either. But draw nigh to God, and He'll draw near to you. Verse 8, "Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up." He'll lift you up. He'll support you. He'll back you if you do that. James knew what he was talking about as far as that part is concerned. He recognized the realization of where to go when we have trials and problems, and tells us to go there, to do that. It's a powerful influence, discouragement is. It's one of Satan's very prominent tools. He uses it often, or all the time, maybe I should say, in ways among people. And we can have various views of that. I've been a minister a lot of years, and I've had to talk to people about that kind of thing in various circumstances and trials, sometimes very severe trials. Now, you don't just laugh about them. You can't do that. They're real. That's not the point. The point is, how do you help people in that situation? Help them out. Help them to recognize that there is a better way once we know God's truth. As soon as you find yourself heading down that avenue of discouragement, as soon as you find that to be true, look to God for help. That's what James is telling us here. If we do that, it's incredible the feeling we can have immediately. It helps right away. Just think about it. It always does. I've done it many times before I ever learned this lesson myself. And how well I've learned it? Well, I don't know. I was joking about that, or shouldn't have. Well, it wasn't a joke, really, but I was talking about trusting God all the way when I was pastoring the Bakersfield Church out in California. And I lived in Tehachapi, and there was about 40 miles of freeway down through the mountain roads, and those mountain roads down through there, those are high mountains out there. And there was... You drive along this road, and some places there wasn't even a rail along the side. And thousands of feet down right off of that road. I told the church down there, I said, be nice if we could just instantly say, oh, I put myself in, I do always the will of God. I do put myself in God's hands right away. I said, if I was coming down that road 70 miles an hour, freeway speed, and on one of those curves where it was thousands of feet down off of the edge, and my right front tire blew out on that car, you think the first thing I'm going to say, oh, I always trust God. Boy, I'm going to grab that steering wheel and see how fast I can keep that thing on the road. You know, first comes self-sustaining life. That's the first thing we want to do, save this old skin. That's automatic. I think we all know that and realize that. Now, I would want to quickly do just that, to trust God, all right, but I'm only illustrating a point. It seems like when trials hit us, you see, we don't instantly say, oh, I do always the will of God. It doesn't quite work that way. I once had a talk to a lady, a fine little old lady. I had to... Well, I was going to say unfortunate. It really wasn't unfortunate. She lived a fabulous life. She was in her late 80s, I believe, when she died. But when she was a widow, I used to visit her quite often because she needed encouragement all the time, was relatively younger in the church, baptized when she was quite an elderly person. And we sat there and we would talk, and she'd always be happy to see me and everything. But one day she just looked at me and she says, Mr. Mishnick, what would you say if I just told you, I don't want to be a king? You know, you tell us that we're supposed to be kings and priests in God's kingdom. What if you were to say, if I were to tell you, I just don't want to be a king? Well, I had to smile and tell her, I don't want to be a king like we see in this world either. I don't want to be a king like some of these that chop the head off of their wife whenever they don't like them or some idiotic thing like that. I said, I don't want to be a king like that. But I said, you don't understand what God's kingdom is going to be like at all. It isn't the case of I don't want to be a king. I said, you'll have a position that will be so good that there won't be any such thing as any thought of discouragement. No thought of it. That's what Revelation 20 tells me. Revelation 20 and verse... Maybe I ought to read that. I don't have to explain the whole situation there for the setting, but in when Christ comes and... Let's see. Verse 21 and verse 4 is what I want. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There won't be any cause for tears then. And He'll wipe away all the tears from there. There will be no more death, nor sorrow. There won't be any sorrow whatsoever. Nor crying, and there'll be no more pain, either mental or physical or any other kind, for the former things have passed away. Now, I said whenever that comes, when that time comes, it isn't a case of I don't want to be this or I don't want to be that. Your position will fit you so perfectly that there won't be a glimmer of sorrow, none whatsoever. That kind of changed the picture a little bit when I described that to her. And I talked to her at some length about this, of course. But what happens? We get scared. I can't do it. I can't fulfill it. I can't make it. You see, that's about the way we tend to look at these things. And who is the author of that sort of thing? Satan, the devil, wanting to discourage us, wanting to get us all of the frame of mind that we can't do it. You just can't cut it. It's discouraging to even think about that. I want to go to Luke, the 19th chapter. Luke chapter 19. Where Jesus dealing with the situation here, very interesting, starting in verse 11. Luke 19 and verse 11. Now, as they heard these things, he spoke another parable because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. Now, they had all kinds of opportunity to get discouraged because it didn't show up in their life. That's for sure. They thought it would earlier in their life. Now, I'm quite sure the Apostle Paul knew better by the time he died, but then at first he did. Thought it was still going to be in his lifetime. At least that's the whole indication of Scripture. But verse 12, therefore he said, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and a return. Now we know who the nobleman was, and we know where he went. He was resurrected and went to heaven to be seated at the right hand of the Father. But the parable says, verse 13, so he called 10 of his servants and delivered unto them 10 minas and said unto them, do business till I come. Now, we could all look at that. Whatever your talents may be or whatever talent you may have or whatever capability you have life. We have to grow. We either have to grow one way, some way, or the other way, we have to grow or we die. I'll get into that a little more here. But his citizens hated him, and of course they killed him, we know that. But and he sent a delegation after them saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. Verse 15, and so it was that when he returned, having received the kingdom, he then commanded those servants to whom he had given them the money, and he called to be called to him that he might know how much each man had gained by trading. Then came the first, saying, Master, your mina has earned 10 minas. And he said to him, well done, good servant. Because you were faithful in a very little, have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Master, your mina has earned 5 minas. Likewise, he said to him, you also be over 5 cities. Now, the first one had the capability that he could be totally content, or else there would be sorrow, wouldn't it? But the second one maybe didn't have the capability of ruling over 10, but he would be totally happy to rule over 5, which is fine. And so verse 17, well done, good, because you have been faithful in very little, have authority over 5 cities. Verse 19 is what I want. Then another came, verse 20. Now, what about this one? Master, here's your mina, which I've kept away in a handkerchief. For I feared you. That's one of the rules of discouragement, isn't it? one of the very facts that can happen. Because you are an austere man, you collect where you did not deposit. Boy, if that isn't the understatement of the whole universe. He collected all the sins of the world, but he never did one. So you collect where you did not deposit and reap where you did not sow. And he said to him, out of your own mouth I'll judge you, you wicked servant. You knew that I was an austere man, collecting what I did not deposit and reaping where I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in a bank, that at my coming I might have collected it with interest? At least it would have gained something. But it was stagnant. Now what happens to a tree when it's totally stagnant? Dead. No mystery about that. You can plant an acorn or whatever. I can use any kind of a seed. And that little plant that comes from that seed, boy, you might say, that really grew a bunch that first year. You'd see that little stem grow way up the first year. And in a couple of years, it would grow a lot more, each year about the same amount on up. And so it grows and grows and grows, and years go by. And it becomes a tree, a pretty good-sized tree. Now you say, well, it never grows anymore. Oh. See, the reality is, every one of those little branches out there, of all of those branches on that tree, all spread out just a little bit, about like that plant did when that first year, down when it was that little tiny plant. And there's that very much more growth because of all of those branches around that tree. It grows, and when it stops, what happens? Dead. Now it's worth nothing anymore. That's the way this man was. Stagnant. Dead. Unfortunately, Jesus said, why didn't you put my money in the bank? At least it had got something. It would have stayed alive. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one that had 10. And they said, well, Master, he has 10. But I say that to everyone that has will be given, and to him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Now, that's the reality of what we need to see. But bring here those enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, and slay them before me. Now, I won't go into Matthew 25 to go through all of the way that he's going to face those people on the judgment. That, can be another sermon as far as that goes. I talked about that in the five wise and the five foolish when I brought out the sermon about the trials and problems that they have. But a tree, if it quits growing altogether, is dead. I don't know, mystery to anybody. We know that. Plants grow or they're dead. We either grow and we can be a plant as far as we are concerned. We just have a physical existence, a life. That's all it is, and we're going to die. That's the surest thing in life. We all know that. We might not like to say it that way, but that's the reality of it. I want to turn to John, the 15th chapter. John, the 15th chapter, and see what Jesus said to his disciples here that night after he'd washed their feet and had the Passover with them. And he was teaching them chapters of material here, beautiful, but I want to cut into chapter 15 and verse 1. Jesus told his disciples here, I am the true vine. Now that vine has to be alive. I'm the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. Now, that's what trials are all about, really. If we really get down to it, that's what they're all about. The pruning process, if you please, to find out, are we going to produce more fruit? Really. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you, he says in verse 3. You're already clean. How can we be clean? Well, only because God can do that, can clean us up. I can't be clean by my own self. I can try all I want to come to God, but I can't do it unless God calls me and gives me that opportunity to become clean. We even use that term, you know, come clean. And in this world, we really need it, I might say. Abide in me, verse 4 says, and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine. Now we get down to the reality of it. You see, Jesus said, if you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you'll live forever. Now, he wasn't trying to make cannibals out of them. Obviously, he said in that very chapter when he explained it, he said, the words I speak to you, they are spirit and they are truth. But they didn't understand it that way. They turned away. We can't do that. And they would only look at it from the physical standpoint. But the reality of it is here. He says, I'm the vine and you are the branches. And if you abide in me and I in you, bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. Without me you can do nothing. I have to be awfully thankful that God gives me this very next breath. It's His air. It's all God's. He created it all. He created everything, the material I am. He created all of that. If myself, I can do nothing, but He gives me the chance to breathe in that next breath and of His air. It's of myself, I can do nothing. It's hard to face that reality. I know that because I fight the battle just the same as you have to, of discouragement. If anyone does not abide in me, he's cast out as a branch and is withered. And they gather them and throw them into the fire, and they're burned. If you live in me, if you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you will ask what you desire, and it shall be done to you. Now, so we can ask anything we want, you know, you can ask for this whole room full of money, and God will do it. You know, it's laughable unless we understand that He absolutely means that we must ask according to His will. And when we ask according to His will, it will be done. Now, I know that, you know, under these hands, the dead have been raised, and I know that. Now, it wasn't these hands that did it, I'll assure you. God did it, and no question about that. The power of God, He'll do it when the conditions are according to His will. Now, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, verse 7, you will ask what you desire and it'll be done. But by this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, so you are my disciples. As the Father loved me, I also love you. Abide in my love. What a beautiful passage that is. Abide in my love. I said that I thought of giving a sermon to take the love chapter and turn it around. You see, 1 John 4 and verse 8 says, God is love. Love is the fulfillment of law. Romans 13:10. Can't even think of it right off the top, but love is the fulfilling of the law. God is love. Fulfilling of the law is God. Full obedience to the law is God then. really is what it amounts to. If we go there first, right off of the top, that's going to dissuade, that's going to get rid of discouragement if we really look to it. And it really will. Now, I thought of giving a sermon and taking the 1 Corinthians 10, the love chapter, and putting it, God is kind. God is true. God is all of these things that it says. Then somebody says, well, Mr. Moody just gave a sermon that gave that. I said, well, fine, then I won't give it as far as that goes. But that's an interesting point. Think about that. God is love. So when you say agape, now I'm talking about agape, not filial love. There's three different words there in the Bible for love, but agape. Agape, the Greek word. God is agape. And if God is love, then that's what we want to become ultimately, as far as we are concerned. We want to actually literally become love, and automatically then there'll be no question about fulfilling the law, because it'll just be inherent, it'll be natural, totally, completely, and entirely. Never any thought of dissuading away from the law. Never. No sorrow of any kind forevermore. But discouragement in this satanic world isn't like that. He deceives the whole world, and you and I are a part of it. And we have those discouraging things come upon us from time to time, and no question about it. I know that's got to happen, and it does happen. There's no doubt in my mind that it happens to each and every one of us, because we're all in Satan's world and all influenced by the prince of the power of the air, the god of this world, 2 Corinthians 4:4 says. And Revelation 12 and verse 9 says he deceived the whole world. Well, we are a part of it, and we can be deceived and are when we allow it to happen. And of course we do, as I said. First thought when a crisis hits, suddenly, save this skin, you know. Save this thing. Save this mess right here. That's what I want to save right off. The Apostle Paul had to go through all kinds of difficulties and trials and tests, and he spent days out in the icy water of the Mediterranean, floating out in there, and you know that he described all of that. I want to turn to Philippians, the fourth chapter, though. Philippians chapter 4. And, you know, Philippians is a very interesting book. It is to me, especially, because the Apostle Paul was so touched by this Philippian church. It was not a real affluent church. It was a rather poor group as far as they were concerned in general. But they went to the trouble of getting a gift to the Apostle Paul when he was in prison. They didn't even know he was there when you read the whole book. But when they found out, they sent a man down there, and he almost killed himself getting there. And the Apostle Paul was so touched by that he wrote this book. But that's not my purpose here. My purpose here is to start in verse 11 of chapter 4. He says, not that I speak in regard of need. After all that he went through, he said, I don't speak in regard of need. For I have learned something that I hope I can learn more and more all the time. I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. If we can learn that lesson, where is discouragement going to come? I know how to be abased, and he sure did. He knew how to be abased, all right. He had to go hungry at times. And he said, I know how to abound. He was born in quite a rich family up in Tarsus. And his father was a merchant, at least that's what history tells us. And he learned probably more languages than all of these other guys put together, because he was there with all of the merchants coming from all of the countries in the world, down through Tarsus on down into the Middle East. His father was a merchant up in that area, so he knew how to abound too. He says, everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry. Both to abound and to suffer need. He sure did. But he said he's content, didn't he? He said, I had to learn, whatever state I am, to be content. Whether he suffers from hunger to abound in suffering and need, I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me. Now, you can too. If you have that complete and total reliance upon God. If you learn not to be discouraged when discouraging things happen. We have to turn the other way. We have to turn to God, the only real source of happiness in the first place. And then you too can do all things if you totally rely on God to just use you to do it, is what it boils down. And when we're fully attached to the only real source of power, then you can say with the Apostle Paul, I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me.